No matter what's on your plate or your mind this holiday season, the UPS Store wants to help. With our pack and ship guarantee, we're helping gifts arrive safely to guarantee more.
They know me so well. Picture perfect gifts.
We're helping guarantee more smiles with our pack and ship guarantee. If we pack it and ship it, we guarantee it. Your items arrive safe or your money back. Stop by your local the UPS Store for holiday help shipping holiday gifts. Visit theupsstore.com/guarantee for full details. Most locations are independently owned. Products, services, prices, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details.
Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell. And my guest this week is a zookeeper, an exotic animal trainer and handler. He's spent the last 10 years working specifically in giraffe conservation. Please welcome Mike Bona. But before we hop into the show, I do have a couple quick announcements. First, my book is on the way. Some of you may not know this, but like many of my guests, I have a pretty wild story myself. And I've seen through sharing it over the past several years that it can save lives. So I wrote a memoir. I'm currently working through 3 rounds of editing with my editor, and then it'll be out in the world. And if you want a quick overview of my story, you can go back and listen to the trailer for this show or go to my website at zachtidwell.com to read about it. And while you're there, join my mailing list so you can get updates about the book and any other big announcements that I have moving forward. Finally, the best way to help this show grow outside of word of mouth is to follow, rate, and review it in whatever podcasting app you're using right now. Or if you're on YouTube, just subscribe to the show. And if you know someone you think I should talk to, have them send me an email at contact.goinginblind@gmail.com. Mike, when I got your notes that you sent me on your background, and specifically when you said that you started working with exotic animals in high school, I immediately pictured, all right, this guy's got 3 turtles, a bearded dragon, a parakeet, and about 12 snakes. Probably no normal, like what would be a normal house pet. Is that accurate? Is that how you got into that, especially at such a young age?
Wow, you nailed me right off the bat. I literally have a bearded dragon behind me right now.
Are you scared of me?
No, I'm not.
That is so funny.
I do have a ball python in the house. I have an emperor scorpion, which technically belongs to my son. And then those are it for like the scaly reptile-y things. But I also have like dogs, cats. My daughter has guinea pigs. It's a virtual zoo here.
I mean, it checks out with everything that you've gone on to do. So I'm glad I did. Kind of hit the nail on the head with it, but yeah. He kind of disappointed me having some dogs and cats in there. I would have thought it was all crazy stuff.
Nah, you gotta have the dog and cats. I love dogs and cats.
Where do you live at?
I'm in Los Angeles.
Okay, so you got this horde of animals right in the middle of the city.
I'm kind of outside the city. I'm Los Angeles County, but if you don't know the area, it's just easier to say Los Angeles. But okay, for those who know the areas, I'm in Santa Clarita, which is north of Los Angeles.
Okay. I was stationed on Camp Pendleton for a couple of years, so I'm somewhat familiar with the area. But all right. I'm curious how, as a kid, you know, I would imagine this path, like, definitely started early because you started working with exotic animals then, but what was the entry into that? Was your family always had all sorts of crazy animals or what?
Sort of. I had, you know, the basic, you know, pets, but I had 2 older brothers. I had one that always brought home snakes and lizards, and I kind of followed in, you know, that same theme. I'd, you know, bring home, you know, wild animals, which I don't recommend people doing now, but it was a different era. Leave animals in the wild is what I usually preach. But, you know, as a kid, you don't know any better. And I would have like pet turtles. You bringing up turtles again. And then what happened is when I was in high school, I think I saw a flyer somewhere for an opportunity to volunteer at this place. It's in Paso Robles, California, where I grew up, which is like central California between LA and San Francisco. But there is an exotic animal outreach facility. It's called Zoo to You. And they had animals they took to like schools and other organizations for educational purposes.
Oh.
And they had an opportunity to volunteer with them. So I thought that sounds amazing. So that's what I did. I filled out the information and I got the opportunity to do that. And it was not one of those things where you show up and they throw like tigers and monkeys at you the same day. It's like you're cleaning up poop, you're prepping diets. I think my first day I was helping build a mew, which is like a shed or enclosure for a bird of prey, like a hawk or an eagle. It was hard physical work. And I think they do that intentionally to kind of just weed people out, because it's not just playing with animals. They want you to recognize this is hard work and they want dedicated individuals. So I stuck through it, and that's kind of where I got my start, is just working with them. And there, you know, it was the first time I got to like pet a tiger and hold a monkey and play with a bobcat and all these exotic animals that you don't get to see or at your typical pet store, you know.
It makes sense that they would do it that way. Like once you said that, I was like, duh, because I'm sure early on they probably didn't do that. And they had a bunch of 16-year-olds showing up who just wanted to play with a tiger, and then they dip out. But so that was high school. Did you immediately go into what your degree was? Exotic, specifically exotic animal training and management? Is that?
Yeah. So the couple that owned Zoodio, they directed me towards the college where they graduated from. It's Moorpark College, which is in Ventura County, also in California. And they have a 2-year program for exotic animal training and management. They literally have a zoo on the campus of the college. It's like a small, like 5-acre zoo, but they have, you know, primates, they have big cats, they have, you know, goats and camels and birds and hawks and stuff. They have, you know, a whole, you know, all your typical zoo animals you expect to see. And it's basically run and operated by the students there. So it's real hands-on learning for 2 years to prepare you to work at a zoo or at like a animal outreach or studio animals, train animals for movies or industry, training animals really in any, you know, police animals, guide dogs, is anything that involves not necessarily exotic animals always, but just working with animals anywhere. They give you the knowledge and the preparation for that.
Is that the zoo that they have there? Is that private just to the students and the staff there?
No, it is open to the public on the weekends. You can go visit the zoo and the students give presentations. They have a little theater there. Most of the animals are hands-on, where they're trained and can come out for shows and demonstrations for the public to learn. And that's kind of, believe it or not, you know, I have a podcast now, and I talk all the time about animals. I used to be pretty shy. I did not want to talk in front of people, but that they push you out there. They give you, you know, they kind of put you in a situation where it's like you're on stage before you know it, holding a snake, telling people about snake behavior and adaptations. And after 2 years of that, it's just old hat. They kind of get all the shyness and the nervousness out of you. You're set to go.
Like trial by fire, where they're like, all right, Mike, you got to go up there and tell everyone about cloacal kissing. That's your task today. Take this mallard out there and tell everyone about it.
Yeah, anyone listening, you could look that up yourself. I'm not explaining that on this program.
That's actually, I specifically wanted to ask you about that. This was an undercover deep dive. But
no, yes, cloaca is one of my favorite anatomy parts. They're fascinating, but yeah. We'll move on.
What's your podcast called?
Well, my podcast is called Wild Tales. Tales is spelled T-A-I-L-S, so it's kind of a pun. But I have guests on. Mostly they're other zookeepers or conservationists or, you know, just friends that work with animals. Or something. I've had a few stand-up comedians because I'm kind of in that field as well. But we just talk about animal stories. So people that have a story that involves animals or wildlife or something, you know, just something that has an impact to them with them in their life that involved an animal of some sort, we talk about it, and at least other discussions about, you know, conservation and wildlife and things we're interested in. So it's a fun podcast. I've been doing it for almost a year now. The episodes are about 30 or 40 minutes, so it's real digestible for people to listen to, like in their car or wherever they're listening to the podcast, and it's available pretty much everywhere.
That's awesome. Dan, that now that you say that, I remember that, because I think that your email address was something akin to that. But again, like you and I talked before we started that I think we connected probably 3 or 4 months ago, but I had to reschedule this because I went out of town and stuff. And now we're just, I think we're both kind of rediscovering stuff that we had initially shared about each other. But when you initially, because like you mentioned that college basically kind of covers the whole breadth of animal training. Do you go there with a particular focus? Like just, you know, how you can major in psychology with a focus on clinical psychology. Is that how it was when you went there? Or do you just get exposed to everything and then you kind of go where you go after that?
You kind of get exposed to everything in the animal world. You can kind of focus on if your interest is specifically zookeeping or if it's conservation or if it's what other aspects am I thinking? Just teaching or whatever. You can kind of focus on those aspects, but you get a feel for everything while you're there. If you have an interest in a particular species of animals, the idea is while you're there for your 2 years, they want you to work with at least one carnivore, one primate, one bird, and one hoof animal, like one ungulate. And you know, that's just four of, you know, I probably work with about, you know, 8 to 12 animals there throughout your year. Some animals you work with for a semester, some are for a full school year while you're there. But they want you to get kind of a feel for everything. So even if you might not have an interest in birds, you got to work with at least one bird. You know, I worked with a couple. I worked with a Harris hawk and I worked with an emu. Two completely different animals, but they're both birds. I worked with a hyena there, which I didn't know anything about hyena. The only thing I knew about hyenas were from Lion King, and they totally misrepresent the hyenas. They are incredibly smart animals. They're fun to work with. They can be affectionate. They can also be kind of intimidating. But I had a great experience working with the hyena there. I worked with primates. Yeah, nice little variety of animals during my stay there.
Yeah, I guess I've heard that they are actually very intelligent, but not the affectionate part. And they look freaky. I mean, is it in a controlled environment like that, especially if they've been raised in a zoo, or do they elicit any sort of, obviously, I mean, they are dogs, but like more of, do they exhibit more tamed behavior being in that environment, or is it still very clear that like, hey, you need to be on your toes around these things?
You definitely need to be on your toes. Basically, working with any of these animals there. Mm-hmm. Hyenas, actually, they're in their own family. They're the Hyenidae family. They're actually not related to dogs. But but like at the zoo, because you know we are students, kind of inexperienced, there are a lot of animals we do work with hands-on, what we call free contact, like kind of with no barriers in between. But animals like the hyena, or there was a lion, there's tigers, there was a wolf, there's certain animals. Actually, I think the wolf did come out with an instructor. But some of these animals, like the hyena, or what's called protected contact. So we did not interact with them without a
condom
protective
on.
Yeah. You get a little ahead of me.
Sorry.
I should have listened to an episode first. I didn't know what I was getting myself into.
I don't take myself too seriously. So sorry. I can reel it in if you would like, but.
Oh, no. I'm going to reel it out now.
All right.
But yeah, they're protected contact. So they stay in their enclosure and we kind of work through the barrier just so they don't eat our face off.
That seems like a smart move. I mean, kind of tying it back into you can go where you're interested into. I know you went into zookeeping, but you also mentioned, you know, you had to work with one of each type of animals at the same time. Is that when you got interested in giraffes specifically?
No, actually, I never had typically an interest or a desire to work with giraffes. Not that I didn't think giraffes were cool. I just didn't really, they weren't on the top of my mind. You know, this is a small zoo. We didn't really have large animals. Like we didn't have giraffes, we didn't have elephants. Camel was probably the largest thing we had. So After I graduated, shortly after, I got a part-time job at the Los Angeles Zoo, and one of the first animals I got the opportunity to work with was a black rhino. And the funny thing about that is that one of the things that Moorpark does is they just grain safety into you. It's like being safety, and, you know, they don't want obviously any students to get injured, but like everything you do with any animals there, you need like a backup, you need a second student. They emphasize, you know, escape protocol on what to do if, you know, you do get bit or injured or whatever. But you always have someone with you as a backup. And then I get to a real professional zoo in the real world. I get assigned. I didn't really, you know, you're new. You don't really get to put in for request what area you want to work with. But I got assigned a black rhino relief, which means there's a 5-day keeper and I'm the relief keeper. So on their weekend, I took care of the black rhino. I got 3 days of training and then I was on my own. And that first day on my own, I'm like, seriously, you trust me to take care of this, you know, 3,000-pound beast by myself? But, you know, you're out there. They expect you. You have the training. You have the, you know, you have the knowledge. And we gave you what we think is enough training that, yeah, that's what they expect from you. And I did the job. I got it done. I was a little intimidated, but I got it done. And now, kind of funny, after working in a zoo for over 20 years, it's like now I'm stuck with the giraffes, and we'll talk about how I got there, but pretty much just throw me anywhere, just I don't need training, I'll figure it out.
Still, that is so crazy. It's like, yeah, you went through 2 years of schooling, but it's a rhino. Like,
right. I've never touched a rhino before.
Wow. Once they get used to you specifically, are they mellow?
Yeah, they do. They recognize the zookeeper as the source of, you know, food and treats, so they do want to kind of be chill and mellow, and you can, you know, hand feed them, you know, apples and carrots and what have you. So yeah, they're pretty cool. They're one of my favorite animals now.
That has to just be surreal. I mean, that outside of like a crocodile is obviously very dinosaur-y. A chicken, even though we don't think about it, is a dinosaur, but like a rhino, I feel like because of the size and the fact that it's armored and it has a horn, like that also feels very dinosaur-esque. Like me trying to put myself in that spot, just it feels like it would be hard to overcome the awe of just the size of it, this thing. Yeah,
so much. I picture working with a rhino like that scene in the first Jurassic Park movie where the Triceratops is sick and lying on the ground, and Dr. Grant's just kind of, you know, resting on its back and its stomach while he's breathing. And it's kind of what it feels like, I think, whenever I touch a rhino. It's like it feels like a big giant Triceratops. They are kind of prehistoric looking, even though, yeah, they're mammals, and obviously dinosaurs weren't.
Were you out there in your proper Steve Irwin attire?
Yeah.
Oh no.
As a zookeeper, and I realize this would be somewhat different from animals, but between animals, is it? I mean, it's 8-hour shift. You come in, obviously, you've got the feeding schedule and stuff like that. You're cleaning out cages and stuff, and then behind the scenes, what else is going on outside of the direct animal care? Always been curious about that.
Well, that could take a whole day, just cleaning up it's cleaning up the, you know, enclosures. You know, most animals, especially in a large zoo, they have a large exhibit area, but also there's usually a large holding area or like a barn they sleep in, that when they're on exhibit during the day, you gotta clean that back area. And then usually in the morning when you come in, if they're already in their barns, you know, you kind of secure them in their barns and then clean the whole exhibit area before the zoo opens and then let them out. And then there's prepping the diets for like the giraffes. They get hay, they get grain, they get produce. They also get a lot of browse or tree branches. And sometimes that involves going around with a giant saw and cutting a truckload of tree branches from in or around the zoo to feed the giraffes. And that can be kind of time consuming. Sometimes there's a lot, you know, sometimes there could be medical things you have to deal with, or animals on medication or need, you know, some kind of treatment for various reasons. There's training. We do what we call husbandry training. So a lot of people think of training, they think of, you know, teaching your, you know, a dog to like sit or circle or turn over. Husbandry training is training for like medical behaviors. So we want to train animals to be able to willingly like stand on a scale or let us take, you know, do a blood draw behavior or give a vaccination or physically like manipulate, you know, the hooves or the feet to like trim the nails or the hoof walls if they're overgrown and stuff like that. Stuff with a large animal, you don't want to have to use anesthesia to knock them down to do all this stuff. So if you can train them to accept it willingly while you feed them treats, that's much better for their health, safety, and well-being.
That's so fascinating. Is it pretty regular to be participating in research too, or is that more of something where you guys, it's an outside organization coming in to do that as opposed to you guys performing that?
Some zoos have like a research department. So depending on what they're trying to research, they have like employees or volunteers out in front of the exhibit, like docking behaviors and seeing what the animals are doing throughout the day.
Okay. So what's the shift from black rhino to giraffe?
So it took me a while to get full-time at the zoo. So as I worked full-time, I got to move around and work with the black rhino. I worked with primates there as well. I worked with the cats and snow leopards, which was pretty cool. And then when I got full-time, I got moved over to what's called the hoofstock section. So mostly like African animals. And then I was giraffe relief there. So I was doing that 2 days a week. Zebra relief and then 1 day demand. So that's 5 days a week. And my demand, I was kind of moved all over the area wherever I was needed. And I kind of just, that was the first time I ever worked with giraffes. And they were kind of just, as I was there throughout, you know, for a couple of years, they kind of just grown on me. And then in 2010, they had a giraffe keeper like conference or workshop. It was at the hosted by the Phoenix Zoo, and I got an opportunity to go. And it's like kind of the first of its kind at that time. And kind of just like I got thrown in this world of giraffe like conservation and what's going on in the wild with giraffes. And but I was retaining information I was not aware of. Like at the time, they were saying giraffes population in the wild has declined like by over 40% in the past 30 years. Like they're calling it a silent extinction because people, you know about, you know, elephants and rhinos being poached and their population is going down because of their horns and their tusks. But no one talks about the giraffes. People just assume if you go on safari in Africa, you're going to see a giraffe. But their populations were diminishing drastically to the point where there are more elephants in Africa than there are giraffes by a 4-to-1 ratio.
And is that still because of poaching?
It's poaching. It's loss of habitat fragmentation. There's a lot of factors that go into that. So I was fascinated by that. And on that, I met Julian Fennessy, who was the president and founder of the Giraffe Conservation Foundation. He was actually a guest on my podcast several months ago. But I was talking to him saying, hey, this is fascinating. I would love to help out and volunteer with you guys. Do you have opportunities for that? And he said, yes. And this conference at the Phoenix Zoo was in February of 2010. By November, I was in Kenya participating with a research project that Giraffe Conservation Foundation is doing on Nubian giraffes in Kenya.
Was that your first time going out of the country, was to Africa to work on this?
Yes, it was.
Wow.
And that's one of those things where my whole life, I've always wanted to go to Africa. That was my dream. And I tell my mom, like, I want to go to Africa. And she's like, well, good luck, because I can't afford it.
Yeah.
You have to pay for that yourself. And then I get, you know, a zookeeping job, which is a job of passion, not really a job of money. So I wasn't funding a trip for myself, but I was able to get a grant to the zoo. So I was able to trick the zoo to send me on their dime.
That's the way to do it. Oh, it's gonna help my it's career growth. I'm gonna bring so much knowledge back, and I'll be able to help the zoo.
Look, it's gonna make the zoo look good. All right, you're sending keepers to do conservation work in Africa. But yeah, it was a dream of mine. I thought, you know, if I can just go to Africa one time, I'll be a happy camper and set for life. But no, it was like a drug. I'm like, it's the most beautiful, fascinating place I've ever been. And then I have been four times since then. Back,
That's so nuts.
Yeah, I've worked with GCF in Kenya twice and Namibia twice. So that's kind of just, after that trip, I'm like, oh, I think giraffes are it. And then like a year later, the lead keeper, the guy that was doing the giraffes 5 days a week, he left, he got a job at another zoo. So I kind of stepped in and I've been the full-time keeper for like the past 10 years working with giraffes.
Wow. And I mean, it sounds like you've kind of found your niche, like you're content just working with giraffes.
Yeah. And I tell people I work with giraffes because they're the one animal that everyone knows. It's a string where I do have other animals, most of their variety of like gazelles and deers that I work with. But if I tell people I work with giraffes, I work with Garinuk, and they go like, well, what's a Garinuk? And it just saves me a lot of trouble if I just leave them out of the equation. But for those that just heard me say that and want to know, Garinuk are a type of African gazelle. And they're also sometimes called the giraffe gazelle because they have a long, elegant neck as well.
Huh. Do they, but I mean, not the patterns or anything. So it's
no,
not,
they're okay. Kind of like a solid, like a tannish color. But males have these very nice, you know, curved horns. And they're just a beautiful animal. They're kind of skinny and slender. They have like these long necks proportionate to their bodies. And they also have a unique ability to kind of stand on their hind legs to make themselves taller to reach leaves off of, you know, taller trees and bushes. And that's,
wow,
that's a feature that other gazelles and antelopes aren't capable of doing.
Well, and that's, I was going to ask about the long neck, if that's because they eat from the trees, but then they stand up too.
Yeah, so it's beneficial for both the long neck and the ability to stand up.
That's, I get, trying to picture that, just, I feel like that's one thing where, like, you know, I don't miss my sight very often. That's something though where like, I want to see that. It's just, that sounds so cool. And did giraffes exclusively eat from the trees?
In the wild, yes, they do.
Okay. Is it a particular type? I mean, with their, you know, habitats fracturing and also shrinking, is it the trees that are dying? Is it everything?
Yeah, mostly. No, there's a variety of trees and plants that they'll eat from. I think acacia is the one most people are most accustomed to. There's different varieties of acacia. We actually have acacia that grow around our zoo, which is invasive to LA, but it's very convenient that we can go out and cut large branches and bring them out to the giraffes to kind of replicate their diet in the wild.
Yeah. So what was I guess either Namibia or Kenya, were either of those, are you guys in sketchy settings or are you in very like somewhat controlled environments because of all the conservation efforts out there with, you know, people security controlling and protecting you guys and all of that stuff?
Those two countries I mentioned are pretty safe. In fact, Julian, who I mentioned, the head guy at GCF, he calls Namibia Africa for beginners because it's really kind of like a safe environment to go on safari and the people are chill and it's great. But yeah, I'm not allowed to go on the more dangerous places. They did a translocation of northern species of giraffes a few years ago in Niger, which would have been fascinating to go to because who gets an opportunity to go to Niger? But that's one of the less safer areas, so it's not one of the places where I was on the list to get the volunteer to go. But there's a lot of the countries that they do work in are pretty, you know, friendly towards foreigners and visitors that help out with these projects.
I get that, makes sense. I mean, it would be a huge, it's probably a big part of their economy, you would think.
Yeah,
so that kind of, there's a benefit to ensuring everyone's safe outside of the normal stuff there. But is it when people are poaching giraffes and hunting them specifically that for I would imagine there's tribes that are doing it for food, but outside of that, is it because of their patterns on their skin?
Yeah, there's various reasons. Yeah, for meat, for the patterns on their skin, for their tails sometimes are used as fly swatters. They have these long, thick hairs on the end of their tails that they use for a fly swatter, but people use them as fly swatters too. Their bones in some cultures are believed to have medicinal purposes. They don't. But yeah, those are some of the reasons that people will poach a giraffe for, or just for trophy hunting.
Which is the grossest of them all. Which,
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, there's really... That's a I have money, fuck you, look at my money kind of thing. I feel in my opinion, right? When it's a trophy hunting thing like that, it's just, I don't really see an excuse for it. And I was actually curious to, I say that because I was also curious to pick your brain on this. You know, at the same time, a lot of funding for conservation does come from those hunts when they're legal hunts. I mean, I was looking up numbers, and people listening, take this with a grain of salt. You know, these numbers that I came from was, or the study that I had looked at, or the source was from Safari Club International Foundation, which is a hunting organization, but they were putting up numbers of, I think that the average of these trips, and they had analyzed from 2012 to 2014. So I'm sure these numbers, the costs have gone up, but I think it was, you know, $27,000 a hunt, you know, just under $27,000 a hunt, and you get thousands of people coming in every year. In your, with you being, you know, in this day in and day out and knowing more about it, what are your thoughts on all of that?
That's a tricky subject to talk about because people are very passionate about it from both sides. But what you're talking about is, in a perfect world, people that donate tens of, or sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars to hunt a rhino or a giraffe or a lion in Africa, they pay for these permits, and the money for those permits goes back into conservation of these animals. And then they'll be directed towards a elderly male lion somewhere that's really kind of towards the end of his life and not producing to the population anymore. And then that's their trophy kill. So if it works in that manner, then there can be, I can see some benefit to that. But then you got to look at what countries are these hunts going on, and is the money going to where they say it's going to? Because there are countries where there's a lot of corruption in the government. So that's the question, is are they really benefiting conservation? So it's a tricky subject. And I think if it, you know, I don't want to say that I'm in favor of any kind of trophy hunting. You know, I definitely don't want to be friends with someone that thinks it's fun to kill, you know, a big, beautiful, you know, exotic animal out in Africa. But if it's done in a certain manner that can benefit conservation, then I can see a pro to that argument. Yeah, but that's always the big question, though. Like, is that how it's working?
Yeah, and I think the other side of that is, okay, is it getting eaten? Right? Are you killing it just so you can have a lion's head on your wall, or is that meat going to get eaten somewhere? Because I know you're not bringing it back to the States. Like, that, what's happening to everything else? Is the entire animal getting used? Like you said, is it a?
With the giraffe, like, ideally the meat should be donated to the local community.
Yeah.
And is it working that way? I don't know. That's why there's so many question marks when it comes to this type of conservation, that it's hard to defend it fully, because I don't know. Because you know there's corruption out there. You know there's cases, and it's case by case, government by government. They're all government agencies. So you don't want to put a blanket over, you know, all of Africa saying this is happening everywhere. Maybe it is being beneficial in certain areas, but you know there's areas where it's not, and that's where the concern is. And you know, I might not be knowledgeable about, you know, every country, every organization, so I can't say for sure, you know, if the money's going where they say it's going. So that's kind of where I'm hesitant to support it fully.
Yeah, well, and I'm glad to hear you talking about that, in the sense of, like, and I think I agree also that generalities generalities are dangerous. And so, like, any sweeping statement is, but I wanted to make sure that we talked about it, because I think most people probably don't realize that there is, you know, that in an ideal world, the thought is that money is going in the long run to help prevent the actual poaching of the animals and stuff like that. But it just, I don't know. It's an interesting part of that whole system that I think more people should know about, at least, you know, to be more educated going into it and considering those things. And just, I mean, awareness is always good, but I have all sorts of like stupid questions I want to ask about how the drafts behave, but I want to make sure that we're able to get into the, you know, the purpose that has come out of this for you. I mean, you've got these four trips to Africa. Obviously you're doing this full time now, but it's turned into more, and I don't mean this in like a cliche way, it literally has turned into more than a job for you.
It's definitely, it's a passion for me. It's something I'm passionate about. You know, I do so much to kind of just drive awareness and funds, you know, when I can for giraffe conservation. And people are like, why giraffes? Because I work with giraffes. They're my life. So that's where I focus my attention. I know there's thousands of other animals and species that need, you know, support and conservation and money. And I support those as well. But this is where I'm actively, you know, putting my time and effort is with giraffe conservation. It's not just the trips to Africa to work hands-on with the Giraffe Conservation Foundation, but I have an annual event here at home that I do. It's called Laughs for Giraffes. I produce a stand-up comedy show that raises funds for the Giraffe Conservation Foundation. So even if I'm not there on the soil in Africa helping out, I can still help out here at home, put on an awesome show where people can, you know, buy a ticket to go see some great comedy, and that money is all going to protect giraffes in the wild. And usually when you support an organization, a wildlife conservation organization like Giraffe Conservation Foundation or other organizations that support elephants or lions or snow leopards or any animals in the world, if you're helping to support that animal's habitat, these animals are what we call umbrella species. So you're focusing on the giraffe, but protecting their habitat, you're protecting all the other animals in the area that live with them. So you're protecting the zebra, you're protecting the gazelles and the antelopes and even the plants and the trees that may be in threat of extinction as well. You know, you're protecting the whole area, and just giraffes are just the name on the conservation effort.
And so that's why they're the umbrella species, is because they're just they have the highest notoriety. So that's where people like what they will rally behind, essentially.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Say if like you're supporting rhino conservation, well, you're giving money, you know, to protect the rhinos, but consequently you're protecting all the animals that live with the rhinos, which may be giraffes too. But, you know, if you're giving money to giraffes, your thoughts are, I'm protecting the giraffes, but you're also protecting the rhinos. But if you're giving money to the rhinos, your thoughts are like, oh yeah, I'm protecting the rhinos, but you're also protecting the giraffes. So it's kind of beneficial to both parties.
Yeah. And if I heard you right earlier, or if I'm recalling right, you've been doing this specifically for 10 years now. Has there been a, because I mean, you know, you also mentioned the declining rates earlier. I think you said 40% over 30 years. Has there been a shift in that trend, or is it still on the decline?
There actually has been a shift. Latest estimates show an increase in giraffe populations. So when I started getting involved with giraffe conservation around 2010, there was around, I think, 90 to 100,000 giraffes in the wild. And now I think the latest estimates have them around 111, 115,000. And that could be due, partially because of the extended conservation efforts that Giraffe Conservation Foundation and other organizations have put towards protecting the giraffes, and also better census taking capabilities. Maybe they have a better count of giraffes.
Better technology, all that stuff.
Yeah. But they're heading in the right direction in most places. Now, they're in, I think, 21 different countries throughout Africa. So it all depends on the areas. There's portions where giraffe populations are growing at a fantastic rate, and there still are areas where giraffe populations are on the decline. And that's just because you have so many different governments you got to work with. If you want to protect the giraffes or any species out there, you have to work hand in hand with the government. Some governments are easier to work with than others. Some have more passion and care more about protecting their wildlife than other countries.
Yeah, it's a Because the landmass is so huge. There are so many countries there. It has to just be a nightmare trying to do anything on a large scale like that and coordinate between all that. With how long ago did you say you started Laughs for Giraffes?
Laughs for Giraffes started in 2016. I've always loved stand-up comedy, and one of the comedy clubs that were close to the zoo, I think I saw on their website, they were promoting, hey, do you have a conservation or a fundraiser that you want to support through a comedy show? I'm like, hey, that sounds like it'd be fun. So I reached out to them and they helped me put together the first Laughs for Giraffes. And I did it at that comedy club for the first 2 years, and people showed up and we had like raffles and silent auction, and people, you know, the portion of the ticket prices went all to Giraffe Conservation Foundation. And then kind of after those 2 years, I kind of built up a small relationship with the comedy community, which is pretty vibrant in Los Angeles. And then I kind of moved away from the comedy club because, you know, they were great. They got me started, but they also, you know, kind of take their own portion, which is pretty much, you know, it's a good chunk. So I've moved on to find other venues and locations after that. And now I really enjoy doing the show like at a local like brewery or winery or place where they just want the people. And they let me, you know, if they let me charge like $20 for a ticket, you know, I could keep the whole ticket price, and they got people coming in to, you know, to support conservation, see some great comedy, but they're buying all their beer and food and such. So that's a good relationship to have.
It's a win-win.
Yeah, it's a win-win. So I'm a little late this year. Sometimes, you know, I usually try to schedule them around June 21st, which is World Giraffe Day, which already passed, but I'm hoping to get an event going probably later in the summer.
Okay. Do you get up there and do stand up too?
I do not do stand up. I don't quite have the nerve for it. Yeah, I recognize that these are professionals that come up and they do this all the time. What I do is I get to go up on stage and kind of talk about the event and giraffe conservation and where their money's going. And then I'll try to throw in like a few jokes, but since that's not my purpose for being on stage, like if they bomb, that's fine. And if I get a couple chuckles, I'm, you know, the happiest guy on the earth.
Yeah. I bet your cloacal kissing bit would kill up there. It's a little off topic, but I mean, it's still wildlife. But you are actually getting professional comedians to come in and do it.
Yeah, I've had some great comedians. Not like the big name ones, although I try, you know, like the household names. I mean, if you're familiar with the, you know, the comedy community and like the lesser known like great comics, I've had like the Sklar brothers, who are very funny, Kyle Kinane, Jackie Cation. You know, these are, you know, comics that have been doing it for, you know, a lifetime, and they've been on like the Tonight Show and all the talk shows, and they've been on, and have had their own specials, and they might not be a household name, but they are great comedians who put on a great show and are very helpful and passionate about helping wildlife as well. So that's what I really like about it. They donate their time, they do a set for free, and they know that they're helping wildlife conservation, and I absolutely love it.
That's super cool. Is it an actual 501c3?
Yes, it is. Okay. You can get information on giraffeconservation.org is their website, and they have information on if you want to learn more about giraffes, if you want to donate, you can even adopt a giraffe through their website if you want to adopt a giraffe in the wild, and they'll give you updates on how your giraffe's doing, where he's at in the world.
Yeah, I guess I didn't realize that you had arranged the comedy events underneath them. That was my bad. I thought this was a separate thing, but that makes sense that you've tied it in with them. Have you been able to keep track? I mean, it sounds like it's pretty established now. Have you tracked the metrics of how much you brought in since 2016?
I usually bring in a couple thousand per event. So over the past almost 10 years, I think it's been about $25,000-$30,000 for giraffe conservation.
That's awesome, man. What else? I mean, you got the podcast going on top of that. I'm sure it's probably a nightmare trying to schedule one of those, the Laughs for Giraffes events. What else is going on?
That's That's what I got. You know, I'm working at a zoo. I'm doing a podcast every other week. Occasionally putting together a comedy show. And outside of that, I got, you know, my own little zoo at home, and I have a couple of kids and a wife I got to take care of. So that's pretty much a full-time job.
I guess, first of all, is your wife also a zookeeper?
We actually met at Moorpark College, so we kind of went through the same training. However, okay. She does work with animals, not a zookeeper, small animal vet clinic. So she's taking care of your sick dogs and cats at work.
Are your kids following in your guys' footsteps?
Unfortunately. And I say that because I kind of wish someone would want to go into like marketing or finance or something that makes money. Come on, they got to take care of me when I get older. But my daughter, she wants to be a veterinarian, I think, which is great. Schooling is going to be a nightmare, but we'll get through that. My son wants to be a marine biologist, which I admire, but I'm like, don't you want to make money?
Yeah, it's hard. And you touched on that earlier. Like, you're like, yeah, zookeeping and working with animals, that is a passion, so it doesn't make money. And that's like, you know, I've thought about that a lot recently. That is the case with a lot of jobs that are, I mean, it's not like people are actively taking advantage of your passion, like, you know, the entities that are employing people, but like that tends to be a trend where it is a job that draws a very passionate person in, where like, yeah, the pay doesn't match the passion anywhere near it. Like, you really have to love what you're doing to commit yourself to it. But
right, it doesn't really match the education either. I mean, we got keepers with like, I have an associate's, but you have keepers with bachelor's, some with master's that really have gone, you know, all in on education to become, you know, an expert in their field working with animals. And, you know, they kind of still are making just the minimum working with, working at a zoo. And thankfully, you know, my zoo is one of the higher paying zoos because it's a city zoo. So I get city benefits, which is nice, and, you know, a pension. But other zoos, you know, like the smaller private zoos, you know, they struggle to pay their keepers well.
And that's where I'm like, okay, then is it someone is taking advantage of the passion? Like, I guess if it's private. So are you technically a local government employee?
I am.
Okay.
I work for the city of Los Angeles.
That's really cool, man. That's super cool. Well, you've got Wild Tales Pod. I'm sure people can go find Laughs for Giraffes with a quick Google. Do you ever think you're going to write a book about giraffes or anything crazy in the conservation world that people should be aware of?
Who knows? I've had people ask me that for years. I'm like, my life's not interesting enough for a book. But more people, you know, kind of ask about it, I start thinking like, maybe there is a book in me somewhere. But that's years down the line. So we'll see where that goes.
All right. I have to ask you two stupid giraffe behavior questions that I've been curious about and trying to like keep myself from asking. But you're a giraffe specialist, so I'm going to ask them. Do they behave like giant horses?
In a sense, yeah. They're, I mean, each one has their own unique personality. So some are really kind of cool and docile. You can hand feed them and pet them. And some are like, just don't mess with me. You know, they don't want to be touched. They might take, you know, a leaf from you or your hand. But other than that, you know, just you want to kind of keep your distance. So they'll kick out and be ornery at you. So it depends on the individual, really. But you can't really ride a giraffe, though.
Yeah, I'm sure someone's tried to ride one into battle before. I would be shocked if in human history no one's ever tried that. But that's another thing, actually. I've seen a video of giraffes fighting before where they are swinging their heads around. I mean, it looks ridiculous, but is that how they fend off predators, too?
No, that's basically how they fight with each other, and that's a male trait. Males fight for dominance, for kind of breeding rights and be able to hang with ladies in the herd. As far as other animals, like they have predators, you know, lions, leopards, hyenas, but they're not going to swing their necks. Their necks are like, you know, they're 15 feet off the ground. They're going to kick, and they have strong, powerful legs. They have a kick that can kill a lion if landed in the right spot.
That is freaking insane. I mean, it makes sense. They're giant, but like that's wild. Well, got the Wild Tales pod. I'll have links to all that stuff in the show notes. I don't think you sent me links to, but I can Google that. Do you have a website that you want people to look for as well?
I just mostly do social media. I got all my podcasts on Podbean, but you can get a link through Wild Tales at Wild Tales Pod on Instagram. TAILS. And then where else? Last for Drafts. Just also, I'm on Instagram, Last for Drafts. If you're in the LA area and are interested in seeing my next show, all the information will be on social media.
Okay, sweet, man. Thanks for entertaining stupid questions and getting out there and doing, again, following your passion to do something that's impactful. I mean, I think a lot of people will admire that from afar, but not actually do it themselves. And so I admire that you've done that, and thanks for taking the time to come on.
Oh, thanks, man. I encourage people to do it themselves. If they want to put on a comedy show or some kind of fundraising event, they can always message the podcast and I'll guide them in which direction to go and how to help out. Cause for any cause, I'm willing to help and give some advice.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
And thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Remember, if you haven't already, rate and review the show wherever you listen, and then share this around with the curious mind who needs to hear it.